and I at once... Well, that shows what sort of a crowd we've got in this morning. Let us at once raise the intellectual tone, Leonis. Yaru, clamat, sunturus, quid est, bestia. Silentium, tonat, quiltius. Yes, Charles Hamilton, probably the most prolific author of all time, with 72 million published words to his credit, the equivalent of 1,000 or more full-length novels, did, under his best-known pseudonym Frank Richards, write a Billy Bunter story in Latin. What intellectual depths are concealed by our guests this morning, who are chiefly famous for their jollity? Gerald Campion, you've played Bunter for 11 years. I suppose it's probably no joke to you.
Well, no, not a joke, no, not really.
Do people still accuse you of being Billy Bunter?
Yes, rather, yes, they do. They accuse me. They not accuse me as much as they used to accuse me, to show me to people, to grab hold of me and say, look, there he is. Not so much now, thank God. Long time ago. It's very useful when you're queuing up for fish. And they recognise you and...
They realise you must be hungry, so they put you
well, out of the two,
do they? Yes. How brilliant were you at school, Jerry?
I was not very good. I was expelled when I was 14 and a half. For doing broadcast here, actually. Did you see me? He said, you can't go on doing both, so you better choose, so I chose. And,
you wicked fellow. I'm not sure you're speaking to Giles Brandreth, who produced a book called Yaru, which is about Billy Bunter's exploit some years ago. Giles, how... Because you had your picture all over the front and he never told you...
Well, I was in the middle of... I've forgiven him.
You've forgiven
I've
him?
I've met him, yes.
Right, take hands with Giles.
Yes,
very nice.
I've forgiven him. Now, I picked out a book in a bookshop, and there I was, like, 12 photographs. I thought, well, he might have sent me a copy.
Ah, oh, but...
He's still open 450, I think.
Will you pay over the 450, Giles? Yes. You can well afford it, because you yourself are practically... As prolific as Frank Richards. 60 books have you written now or more?
Yes, Barbara Carson and I are neck and neck, if you'll pardon me using the word. Yes, certainly. But nobody could ever be as prolific as Frank Richards was.
How brilliant were you at school, Giles? Do you think you were a very clever lad?
Well, I was all right at the paperwork. It was the sport that I loathed. And when I left school for the last time and didn't have to go onto the rugger pitch again, I knew I would never, ever be unhappy anymore.
I'm not at all sure that you're speaking to another of our guests, Nicholas Parsons, who actually beat you at a great competition of public speaking.
No, we drew. We
you
drew.
Drew.
Oh, yes, yes. An honourable draw.
How long did you both speak for, Nicholas?
11 hours. And it was all for charity, for action research for the crippled child. And the adjudicators, because we had people listening, you know, we had to try and keep them awake, decided that I don't know what was going on in the other room, because Charles was talking in another room. And they decided after 11 hours that one of us might collapse, and they thought this was very bad for charity. And so they decided after 11 hours they would stop the whole thing and before one of us was carried out.
You are often abused in the public print, Nicholas. You
yes.
As the chairman of the...
I have read it.
Yes. Do you think people are very unfairly nasty to you?
I think they knock anybody who shows that are sort of are not very demanding on the general public. They feel that the public should always have their sights lifted and should be enlightened and so forth. So if you do a very low market type of show, and after all, there's a mass audience, and they love very simple things. They love games of any kind. And therefore, I think the press are rather sort of highbrow about this sort of thing.
You aren't accused of being a public school chap, are you?
Oh, yes, I was at a public school.
But you've lived it down to some extent, haven't you?
Yes, I mean, I don't think it matters these days, whether you're at a public school or any kind of school. It's, thank goodness, one mixes. It was all much more obvious when I was young, whether you were a public school or not.
I think there's one possible rival to you in terms of actual abuse by members of the press, and that's Stuart Hall, who... It's a knockout.
Yes, that's right.
It's a knockout, comes back. I'll try. A successful game is invented.
Well, in fact, the most, in commercial terms, the most successful is something called the Alice in Wonderland game, which is a very simple game for children, where you race through Wonderland, getting bigger and smaller as you go along. But the games that I enjoy playing are slightly more...
24 Hours for Grown-Ups, and the paperback collection of Sips from Ripping Yarns by Michael Palin and Terry Jones.
Well, the first of these Greyfriars for Grown-Ups is quite simply a celebration of what must now be the most famous fictional public school of all time, and of course of its star pupils, including the famous five of Harry Wharton and Bob Cherry and Frank Nugent, as well, of course, as people like Hari Jumpit Ram Singh, H.R.H. the Nabob of Ballypur, and of course that fat, fabulous, cruising fraud, the fat owl of the remove himself, William George Bunter, next to whom the personification of which I am sitting. According to the school prospectus, Greyfriars was founded by Edward VI in 1551, but it didn't become a nationally known and loved institution until the publication of the boys' paper The Magnet in 1908, when the late Frank Richards began chronicling the adventures of the pupils of the lower four, known as the Remove, and he kept on chronicling them until he died half a century later. So for 50 years, for Greyfriars addicts at least, the world stood still,
while Harry Walton saved the day, and Billy Buncher squealed and cackled and yarrowed his way through misadventure after misadventure. In fact, over the weekend when I was doing this prep, I calculated that if you add up all the whops on the bag, which means the strokes of the cane, received by Buncher in that half century, it tops the million mark. Greyfriars, there is, of course, plenty of violence, but no sex. No crumpet, but loads of crumpets. Because the world of Greyfriars is a world on which the tuck shop never closes. Witness the school song, which is quoted in one of these books. Long live the tuck shop, place of cheer, which gains our warm approval. Thank goodness we need never fear its permanent removal. So long as Greyfriars stands erect and keeps its proud position, the famous tuck shop, we expect, will carry on its mission. The motto of Greyfriars is Con amor tenues grandeur, which I will translate for the benefit of those who didn't go to St. Paul's or Shrewsbury and didn't have the teaching of Ayatollah Quelch, who was the form master of the remove. Both slight, we strive for greatness. Now, the motto of Greybridge, on the other hand, is Pecuniam habere nobis necesse est. We need the money. And Greybridge is the school in the Greyfriars tradition created by Michael Palin and Terry Jones for their series Ripping Yarns, and that's the other books that you gave me. Well, of course, the difference between the two schools is that Greyfriars is for real, but Greybridge is a spoof. It's a very funny send-up, but it is a spoof all the same. For example, right at the beginning, the hero, Tomkinson, who is the Harry Walton of Greybridge, goes into the headmaster's study, the door shuts, and after a moment, the sound of caning begins. Says Tomkinson, beating the headmaster was just one of those ghastly chores that produced such depression within me. It is funny, and you can't deny that there are more arts in the life of Brown than there are in the New Testament, but that doesn't stop you finding the Bible a bit more satisfying. And the world of Greyfriars is very satisfying. Frank Richard believed in it completely. I mean, he used to say, not as things are, it's as they should be. And the Magnus' motto was clean, wholesome literature, which is exactly what Frank Richards provided. Whether or not it's what Michael has in mind, I don't really know. Frank Richards wasn't at all modern. He was born in the year of Custer's Last Stand, and he did once say that if there is a Chekhov among my readers, I fervently hope that the effect of the magnet in my stories will be to turn him into a Bob Cherry. But he also evokes a marvellous world of innocence and fun with a style that's quite hypnotic. And when all said and done, a man who can create an immortal character like Buncher and translate the whole of Gilbert and Sullivan into Latin has to be some kind of a genius.
The Latin thing is really quite a surprise. He was a good, very good Latin scholar indeed, wasn't he?
He was, but of course, the reason he wrote about a public school, I think, in part, is because he didn't go to one. And the reason he was obsessed with Latin is because he really wasn't totally familiar with it. And the sort of people who are always coming out with Latin tags are usually people, I think, who'll be a little insecure about it. His Walking Matilda, though, in Latin is charming. Veni ut saltimus, veni Matilda, veni ut saltimus Matilda, veni.
As you can see, the when the Clive Jones is listening to this, you're Stuart Hall's only fan.
Why did he translate the whole of Gilbert and Sullivan into Latin? Well, largely because I think he was a workaholic who lived alone. He had no vices except for gambling and wearing a toupee, which he eventually gave up for a much more becoming skullcap. And he, I think, sat at home at his typewriter alone for all those years. I mean, at the age of 30, he was writing the equivalent of a full-length novel a week. And even when he was 80, he was churning out 250,000 words a year. And he needed to keep himself busy. I think he was quite a lonely person.
He wrote the ones in the gym as well, didn't he, under another name?
Yes. And in fact, the book, Greyfriars for Grown-Ups, is also about St. Jim's, which is the school in the gym. And the aficionados of both Greyfriars and St. Jim's really don't care so much for Buncher, curiously. What they like are the famous five. I mean, they like the hero figures and the yarn element.
There's also the extraordinary element of nostalgia for anyone looking back on it now. There's a passage here about the world-famous circuit in camp, the cycling party. Five bicycles stood packed in a bunch under the big trees that shaded the lane. On either side, meadows and hedgerows ran up the slopes of the glorious downs under a sky of cloudless blue. It was hot. Even Hari Jamset Ram Singh found it warm enough. The famous five had camped there overnight, but in the morning they had not gone on their way. Near at hand was a deep, shady little wood, and in the wood a rippling stream, and the chums of the remove had spent a happy morning swimming and bathing. They were in no hurry.
In the long summer holidays, they had time to kill, so they were taking things very easily. There's not much more of this. Dinner in camp was followed by a luxurious rest in the thick grass under the shady old elms and beaches, through whose leafy boughs the sun rays filtered like arrows of gold.
Oh, well,
I yet to discover why, because in those days one does not accept it as sort of authoritarian dictatorship and didn't inquire into it as you do nowadays. But first of all, it was the magnet that was banned, and then the gem. And then they put a sort of moratorium on even the others, like the Hotspur, the Triumph, and the Rover, which will bring back memories for some people who might be old enough to be up early and listening. And we were only allowed to read The Modern Boy, which I read avidly, and I thought those were actually marvellous stories, but they were, as I said, coming out why. Well, The Modern Boy had these true adventure stories, Biggles, you know, Catherine Johns, and Captain Justice and his gang. But the magnet, and actually, I used to buy the magnet, and I was told I was reading subversive literature, and I used to take it home and read it under the bedclothes.
Why was it banned? Do you know what it said?
Well, nobody ever told us.
No, really, Bunce, it was banned by Chelmsford Library.
Oh, yes, that's right. She said they lied woman out there, and they said it was an immoral character, which, of course, he was. It was highly immoral. I mean, lied, cheated, stole, got away with it.
I think that's probably what the schools disliked. Billy Bunter was a hero figure to the schoolboys, and he did all the things they were teaching him not to do. He was sly, he was difficult, he was prevaricated. He used to act up and take the absolute mickey out of all the schoolmasters. And I think they thought it might give some ideas, and they'd start doing the same. It was all against all the traditional...
But he wanted to be a practical character, didn't he? And the Harrys, the Whartons, and the Terrys. I think people felt they sort of identified with the Whartons and the Terrys. They were always the normal.
Oh, yes, I mean, in this book, this one, the one you've just talked about, he says that it was badly cast, but luckily, just to say this is apart from me, of course, I wouldn't be mentioning it. And it wasn't so much that, although it was in some ways badly cast, poorly cast, yeah. But I mean, the parts were so dreadful.
Yeah.
I mean, Nugent is the non-starter of the year. I mean, Nugent says yes, Wharton and no Wharton and all that. I mean,
there was somebody who does that.
And I mean, they had Michael Crawford playing Nugent.
Really?
He can't do much better. And actually, Valentine playing Lord Malevra, but they still say poorly cast.
Oh, yes,
what do they want? And Eileen just did the sex. And they say the sets weren't very good. I mean, there's something funny.
When you first played the part of Girl Camping, you were not a schoolboy, were you?
No, I wasn't a schoolboy. I was 30-odd. 30-odd with children.
And how did you come to get the part? Because you were first to play...
That's a long, boring story.
Well, give us a...
It's boring.
Give us the edited highlights. You first played it in the circus,
I had a club in Shaftesbury, not in Shaftesbury, in the Haymarket, called the Buckstone. And which many a hangover came out of. And I used to work and run it illegally until 3 a.m. And one day, a man came in called Alan Bromley, who I'd been at Rada with, and he looked at me a lot, and we'd had a great reunion. And he looked at me a lot, and he said, I didn't say anything. He went away, and I had a phone call from a woman called Joy Harrington, who said that she was looking for someone to play around, and I said, yes, I knew she was. And he said, why haven't you been to the bar? And I said, because I don't want to be kicked all over the BBC. And she came down, and I got it.
And he went on for 10 years?
For 10 years, yes.
And you did wear padding, Gary,
didn't you? I wore a suit, a K-pop suit, and zipped from the top and to my wrists and my ankles. And if I felt terribly bored with the rehearsals in Studio One, I used to faint or pretend to faint. No, this was like, he's ill, we can't get another thing on me at all, I'm just bored.
Did you find it funny? Did you enjoy doing it?
Yeah,
did
I loved watching
a terrible
him. Watch him. I'm sure you do the same. Mm-hmm. If you do a funny sketch. You then when you see it again, you laugh, don't you? You must have laughed at that thing. I mean, you laugh yourself, and you don't laugh at you, you're laughing at it.
Yeah.
And I call him him. Mm. I used to call him him. I don't know what he's talking about, but it was a long ago.
Has it got any relevance to today's society? No, I don't think it has, but the characters of Falstaffian dimensions. I mean, there'll be somebody like Sherlock Holmes that will live forever.
What is the scale of the Frank Richards Admiration Society, the Billy Bunter fans?
Oh, well, that is, of course, the old boys' party, which is, they gather. And they are most unlike normal enthusiasts. No, because normal enthusiasts, have trousers that are an inch too short for them, and ankle-length white socks and sandals, and look slightly strange. But these people are very civilised, and they have annual dinners, and they really carry the cult through enormously. I mean, were you invited ever, Jerry?
Oh, yes, I went up to Santa. I gave him a I can't say anything off the cuff. They give a speech and they kept asking me things like you just asked me, was I unzipped? I will just tell you, but I had an idea when we were near the end of the series. I had an idea. I thought, let's get away to England. So I went to the BBC or somebody, and I said, look, I've got an idea for the next series. Malevra, he's the rich one, uncle lends them a yacht, and they're allowed to go on a cruise around the world on condition that Quilp goes too and teaches them on board, and then they agreed, I couldn't believe it, but they agreed to go to Malta, Naples, Nice, Venice, and three other places in the statement for about £5.
That's why you put up the
What?
Well,
we go abroad. Oh, that was a dire idea, but I didn't realize it was going to be they were going to not have any money. So there was a director, to coin a phrase, there was a floor manager, and there was a cameraman, that Miles cameraman, I forgot his name. And we went, and the point of this story is that we eventually ended up in Malta at the Phoenicia, which was then the only hotel there. And they were chanting in the street, go home, go home, go home. Not to us, personally, just generally to the British. This was years ago, too. 61, they were still doing it. And I was called to be done, made up, and ready to go at 8 o'clock in the morning. And the director was drunk, so we had to go and sober him up. And when we got him sober, we got him into a cold bath and got him dressed. And I left him to go downstairs in his lift. And I went back and I got dressed. There was nobody to dress me, and there was no makeup girl or anything. And I got this wig on with great difficulty. And I got the trousers. And, I mean, you all here know what he looks like. I mean, to say it was outrageous. And I got in the lift with my makeup on. And the lift boy looked at me and said, are you leaving today, sir?
Nicholas, there was a good, quite serious attack on these stories by George Orwell some years ago on Boys Weekly, who said that the whole influence of the Greyfriars thing was entirely bad because it was so chauvinistic and because it was written about foreigners and so on. So it isn't so serious.
No, I think that actually what Frank Richards did, he was a great upholder of the establishment. And the Harry Wharton and his group were the complete establishment figures, and he was trying to perpetuate a way of life that was maybe he sensed was about to die. But what he did, which I think maybe the school didn't like, was he brought in all kinds of things which weren't discussed, such as socialism and the underprivileged and fair rate for the job and all kinds of little political items which. And I'm surprised that George Orwell, with his brilliance, didn't recognise it.
Isn't it a bit disturbing, too, that some of the characters you read as a kid, like Biggles, for example, are now attacked for being racist, for being extreme right-wing, for putting over a totally false idea of what the social order should be in Britain. Because yes. I actually didn't see it that way. It didn't do me any harm, and I enjoyed it.
I didn't read Biggles to find out what the social order should be. I mean, it reflected a certain time, a certain sort of adventurous hero.
That's right. And you identify with it, and he was writing about the period that existed. So,
I thought Biggles was as good as his adventures were, and Bunter was as good as the jokes were, and all that.
Yes, as much as I admire him, and think he's marvellous, he was a bit racist. I mean, you know.
Well, he had Ramsay.
Well, yes, but I mean, I will not on the air tell you this. This isn't not this vulgar.
Just about
this offensive man. Not. I'm merely going to say that we did have to alter some of the words.
Mm.
Not the lines, but some of the words. He called certain people certain things which you couldn't get away with. At least only my father-in-law can get away with it.
Well, Jerry just told us about a BBC trip aboard for £5, was it? Something of that sort.
I'm sorry, yeah,
old days. And you of course, Nicholas, you've been tapping around with your cricket team, haven't you, Gertie?
Well, last summer was golf, yes. And the King Lord Taverner and helping...
My cousin was a private in the letters. I mean, he was, said Hillary. Oh, he was, sneered Bolsover. Turned out for being a mollycoddle. He is discharged. He lost both legs in the fighting on the Somme, said Hillary, with a quiver in his voice. There's a whole series of these little things.
Do you like it?
Point.
Michael?
Well, the Greyfriars story and all that.
Mm.
Well, I read an awful lot of them there. I used to enjoy Tom Merry rather. I liked, I think it was called Anthony Augustus Darcy.
Mm.
Couldn't pronounce his R's, I suppose, like that.
And Trimble.
Bad and
Trimble. Trimble
was
the
banter.
You always wanted to be an explorer, so I read.
Is that so?
Yes, I did. I found that it really was my sort of childhood ambition, but they never had been explored. There was nowhere apart from the Amazon. And people had explored the Amazon, they just hadn't come back to tell you about it. But I still would like to go travelling to sort of rather remote places in the
world. And is British Rail going to do this for you, fulfil your ambitions?
Well, I hope so. We're going to be Euston to Manchester.
This is a serious...
Go on beyond that.
A serious business?
Yes. I mean, the idea is to do a one-hour film of railways in Britain and Scotland.
Well, look out, look out. Yes, quite. Cue it home, start a little knockout. Or if you're foreign, just don't front the air.
Last one, and we've had to save up for that one too. Thank you all for listening.